Hello from David Rutledge. Welcome to another Earshot podcast. Great to be with you. And we're about to explore a strange chapter in our scientific history. It's all about rabbits. Rabbits arrived in Australia with the first fleet, but they didn't really thrive. The Great Rabbit Plague that we all know about began in 1859, when Thomas Austin of Barwon Park near Geelong decided to organise a spot of hunting, and he released 24 rabbits into the wild. Good one, Thomas. In just 20 years, those 24 rabbits had become a plague of 1 billion. They laid waste to the land, and Australia's pastoral industry was facing collapse. Well, in this program, producer Lorena Allam looks at how the rabbit plague drove our nation to some very desperate measures.
The Talks Department of the ABC present another documentary program in the series
Operation Rabbit.
As night falls into Neloquin, sheep farmer Colin McCrabb is loading his trusty .22 rifle.
Wabbit wakes.
He fires up his spotlight and drives off into the night on the hunt for an old enemy.
I can recall as a small child going out with my father and looking up at this hill, part of which was covered in bracken fern. He clapped his hands and it was almost as if the whole surface of the ground got up and ran into the bracken fern. There were just hundreds upon hundreds, perhaps thousands of rabbits. It's a sight I'll never forget.
Attention! Ladies and gentlemen, attention! There is a herd of killer rabbits headed this way and we desperately need your help.
All over the world, farmers and scientists are searching for new ways of killing rabbits.
The old saying is three rabbits, 3 years, 3 million.
Kill the rabbit, kill the rabbit, kill the rabbit.
Kill the rabbit?
Well, there were actually rabbits on the first fleet. They didn't thrive initially and they virtually died out. So in 1859, Thomas Austin at Barwon Park near Geelong in Victoria decided he'd add a touch of home and organise a spot of hunting. And he'd release a few European birds and animals into the wild, including 24 rabbits. And those 24 rabbits in the next 20 years went on to multiply as rabbits do, hence the plague of a billion rabbits by the 1880s.
That's Stephen Dando Collins, a historian and writer, and this is the story of how a billion rabbits, eating and breeding and hopping their way across Australia, drove our nation crazy like Elmer Fudd. And like a cartoon, this story is larger than life. It involves biological warfare, romance on a small island in Sydney Harbour, a world-famous actress, the great scientist Louis Pasteur, and $10 million. But first, back to Stephen Dando Collins and those billion rabbits.
The big problem with rabbits was, and is that they eat right down to the roots, so they leave nothing. And they just leave whole fields bare. Now, at that time, the colonial governments, there was no income tax, there was no company tax, so their biggest single source of income was from the lease of crown lands. And in the west of New South Wales in particular, these properties were often quite marginal to begin with. Once the rabbits reached there and then stripped it of all the crops and stock feed, these places began to become dust bowls and totally useless to farmers. And so by the late 1880s, by 1887 in particular in New South Wales, a lot of these leases were coming up for renewal. And the farmers said to the government, if you don't sort out this rabbit problem, we're just going to walk away. We will not renew our leases.
When the House has come to order.
Rabbits hopped their way into Parliament. By 1883, colonial governments had legislated against the rabbit, not that it made any difference to them. In New South Wales, the rabbit minister administered the Rabbit Nuisance Act. The government subsidised rabbit culling by paying a rebate on each scalp. An industry grew, and it was never short of work.
Men flooded to the country districts because a bounty was being paid on the scalps of rabbits. Initially, it was 30 pence. It soon dropped until it was just one penny per scalp because in 1887, for example, on just two properties near Wilcannia in New South Wales, In 12 months, 782,510 rabbits were caught, and they were still saying that the property was useless. 40,000 a month at one property near Silverton. At Menindee, 342,295,000 rabbits in 3 months were scalped by 108 rabbiters. The word came back to the government in Sydney, it's just not working. They tried everything. All sorts of amazing gadgets were invented in Australia and New Zealand to poison the rabbits, and they would pump carbon gas down rabbit holes. They would explode them. There were some rabbiters on horseback who would chase after the rabbits with the netting to capture them, but because the numbers were just too great.
I tried and I tried, but I just simply can't seem to catch that old wabbit.
If at first you don't succeed, Elmer, try again.
Try again? Yeah, but how long will it take?
In 1887, New South Wales had a brand new premier, Sir Henry Parkes, who decided it wasn't going to take any longer. Parkes appointed an intercolonial rabbit commission, made up of prominent graziers, men of science and government administrators. Its task was to find a biological solution to the problem of the rabbit.
It is hereby notified that the government of New South Wales will pay the sum of £25,000 to any person who will make known and demonstrate at his or their expense any method or process not previously known in the colony for the effectual extermination of rabbits, subject to the following conditions. 1. That such method or process shall, after experiment for a period of 12 months, receive the approval of the board. 2. That such method or process shall, in the opinion of the said board, not be injurious or noxious to horses, cattle, sheep, camels,
now,
goats,
this was
wine.
Extremely revolutionary. There was no microbiologist in Australia, so Parkes was obviously well read. And so he, via the New South Wales government, implemented an international competition calling for a microbiological remedy, and they offered a prize of £25,000, which was in excess of $10 million in today's money. So it was a big, handsome prize. They were spending upward of $30 million a year on rabbit bounties, and clearly that wasn't working. So if they paid, you know, only a fraction of that in this prize and it worked, then they were well ahead. So they advertised around the world, and they received 1,500 entries from all corners of the globe.
And, of course, all sorts of mad schemes were put forward, most of them pretty insane.
Brian Coman is the author of a brilliant book on the history of rabbits in Australia called Tooth and Nail. Brian was a research scientist with the Victorian Department of the Environment for 23 years and spent much of his working life fighting rabbits.
Some of the strong contenders were people who thought, well, let's bring in something that will eat the rabbits. In fact, some animals were brought in. Mongooses, I presume that's the plural, not mongoose. They brought in feral cat or cats. There was a whole trainload of cats dispatched up into outback Australia and let loose at various points along the line.
It's a sign of the desperation in the colonies that such crazy schemes were entertained. Brian says the New South Wales government was seeking a magic bullet solution to rabbits because the usual methods of keeping their numbers down were, and still are, expensive, backbreaking, and never-ending.
Back then, the first sort of crude methods, other than trapping, which was entirely ineffectual, there were bounties offered, they were entirely ineffectual. And then they started using broad-spectrum poisons, things like arsenic and phosphorus. And these were, of course, terrible poisons to use in the bush because they were non-specific, and many other animals got killed as well. They were also very dangerous. And my father has a recollection as a little boy of coming home at night after he'd been out with his uncle poisoning on a farm up near Euroa, and rubbing his hands in the dark, and they glowed, and that was phosphorus all over his hands. So, occupational health and safety wasn't a big deal in those days. Yeah.
So the phosphorus literally made him glow in the dark?
Yes, yes.
Was it effective against the rabbits?
Well, yeah, it killed lots of rabbits, as did strychnine, but it killed lots of other things too.
Of the 1,500 entries to the competition, there were a handful of sensible suggestions, including one from the great man of science himself, Louis Pasteur. Pasteur claimed he could eradicate rabbits using chicken cholera. He dispatched his nephew, the scientist Adrien Loire, to Australia. Stephen Dando Collins says that Pasteur expected it'd take 6 weeks to demonstrate his solution and claim the £25,000 prize.
He'd been working on chicken cholera, and he actually found a vaccine for chicken cholera. And in the process, he'd used rabbits in the laboratory as test animals. And chickens that had been in cages and infected with chicken cholera had obviously died. And he put rabbits in there to wait the next experiment. And within 24 to 48 hours, these rabbits had died. And so he just made a mental note, so that had been in his head for several years when this competition came up. And to prove it, before he sent his team out to Australia, he appointed his protege, his nephew, Adrien Loire, who was only 23, 24 at the time. I want you to conduct experiments. So he conducted the experiments in the laboratory, and they again proved that rabbits were killed very quickly by chicken cholera.
And at that point, you say that Adrien Loire came to Australia with some chicken cholera in his luggage.
In his luggage, strapped around his waist to keep it active in tubes.
Oh, I'm sorry, what do you mean, keep it active?
A body temperature of 37 degrees was to keep the culture alive, the chicken culture alive. It needed to be the temperature of 37 degrees, and the human body, its temperature is 37 degrees. So in strapping it around his body, he actually kept this culture alive. And so he brought it out with him without telling anybody on the ship that he was carrying this virulent culture. And when they arrived in Melbourne, the New South Wales government said that they cannot bring this into New South Wales. It's too deadly. But finally, Sir Henry Parkes pushed the commission to allow the team to come to Sydney.
The Argus of Melbourne, Monday, May 7th, 1888. Rod Island has finally been selected as a site for experimental purposes, with the test to be applied for chicken cholera as a means of eradicating rabbits.
They were afraid the microbes would escape into the air and infect the whole colony. So they needed a quarantine facility, and an island was the ideal place to do this. And they looked at various islands, Shark Island and several others in Sydney Harbour, until someone said, well, wait a minute, there's that little island near Balmain, Rod Island, what about that? So they took a look at it and said, yeah, this would be ideal. And Sir Henry Parkes said, yes, not a problem. And he, in fact, put up the money, $1 million in today's money, to have a research facility thrown up there very quickly. It was built in 3 months, built from corrugated iron. One of the buildings is still there to this day, the accommodation house. There was a laboratory, there was a kitchen facility, and a large storage barn. And so they actually piped gas out to the island and the accommodation wing. So this facility was ready for experiments.
We're on the eastern side of the island, and what we're looking at here is we're looking at the reclaimed area here on the north side. So that was reclaimed for a recreational area. And what you see up here, we're looking at the hall on there. That was Louis Pasteur's house when he was over here experimenting with the rabbits.
David Thompson is with the National Parks and Wildlife Service, who these days look after all the islands in Sydney Harbour. On a gorgeous sunny midwinter's day, we're heading across the very calm, sparkling waters of the Parramatta River to Rod Island. It's very small. You could kick a football from one side to the other. And it has million-dollar views of Sydney in every direction.
Yeah, we've just got off the boat, and this is where the original wharf was, but it also comes up to the plaque that we have commemorating the history of the island.
The schedule of experiments is as follows. 1. To inject 9 rabbits with food containing microbes of chicken cholera, placed in equal numbers in wooden hutches, wire-bottomed cages and artificial burrows with healthy rabbits. 2. Feed sheep, cattle, calves, lambs, horses.
Over on this side here, being the eastern side, that was where they kept all the animals. Now, when they came out here, they built all this, what you can say, infrastructure, but they originally wanted to use Shark Island, they wanted to use Bradley's Head, but they were knocked back because back then the public and the locals around the area had wanted nothing to do with this biological stuff. Now, if you'd like to take a walk around the front of the island where it's nice and sunny today.
Yeah, let's do that.
And walk along the balcony.
Numerous experiments did prove that chicken cholera killed rabbits and killed them quickly. There was some question about how quickly the microbes spread between rabbits, and they did kill local birds. And this was put up by the Rabbit Commission's senior officers as a major obstacle. We can't allow chicken cholera into the colony if this is going to kill native birds. So, in principle, it would work.
It killed them, but the trick was they wanted something that was a contagious disease. The chicken cholera, they had to eat the baits that it was on. So even if one had eaten it, it could hang around with as many rabbits as it liked, but it wouldn't kill them because they needed to eat that same thing. And that's why it was rejected. They were looking for something that was very, very effective that they could give a handful of rabbits and that would take care of it.
The original terms of reference of the competition were that these experiments would take place over 12 months. So now poor old young Loire and his team have to twiddle their thumbs for 12 months. Meanwhile, Pasteur back in Paris is saying, I need the money, I need the money, I want to open the Pasteur Institute.
So what does happen? They have to wait, they're running out of money. What does Loire do then?
Loire is aware that Pasteur has invented a vaccine for anthrax. And there's this disease in New South Wales called Cumberland disease, which sounds to him very much like anthrax. And he goes to Junee in New South Wales, and farmers and doctors and people, the newspaper men, come from far afield to see him carry out his experiments, where he, number one, proves that Cumberland disease is in fact anthrax, and then he shows how the vaccine can save the cattle industry and the sheep industry in New South Wales. And he, within 12 months, in fact, has produced more money than the rabbit eradication prize and sent it to Pasteur. And it's with that money that Pasteur is able to open the Pasteur Institute in Paris.
For the next 4 years, Loire and his team manufactured the anthrax vaccine on Rhode Island. And then in 1891, Adrien Loire's life got a lot more exciting, thanks to a visiting actress and a couple of dogs.
Sarah Bernhardt was the superstar of her age. She was a French actress. The Prince of Wales and Freud and all sorts of people were her admirers. And she was Madonna combined with J-Lo combined with, you know, she was absolutely huge in her day. And she brought her entire acting troupe to Australia. And they were going to do a tour. She arrived with two little dogs. And just as Johnny Depp ran foul of the quarantine regulations, she had her two dogs taken off her. And she was threatening to leave the country. It's all sounding very familiar,
it
isn't
is.
It? And but young Loire approached her and said, he'd bought season tickets to all her, he's going to see every one of her shows every night. He's such a fan. And so he approaches her and said, I think I can convince the New South Wales government to declare Rhode Island a quarantine facility for the purpose of keeping your dogs, and I'll look after your dogs while you're in Australia.
And she came over every weekend. Now, she charmed young Adrien, and he suspectedly fell in love with her, and he went to every show that she did, took her out to supper every night, and also they used to come here on weekends, and she used to visit her pug dog. She also had a St. Bernard. If I could read you the list, she had a bear. She had possums in a hotel room in the Australia hotel. And funny about the Australia hotel, when she got here, it was the first guest, and they wanted her to be the first person to put her name in the guest book, which she did as well.
And so he becomes very popular with the Divine Sarah, as they called her. During her Sydney season, every night she would invite him back after her performances to dine in her hotel with her at midnight. And then he said, well, you must come out to the island and I'll get my French chef to cook you a meal. So she comes out with all her entourage, her actresses and actors, and they drink champagne. And at one point they drink so much champagne that Sarah and a couple of her lady friends are found on the roof of the laboratory.
They also say that there's rumours that there was a bit of an affair happening out here as well. But Adrian, he was only 29, and she must have been in her mid-40s at that time, but she had a reputation of, I guess, enjoying the company of younger men. Yeah, so if you'd like, we'll walk around to the front part of the island and have a look over here.
And many, many years later, he revealed in a very obscure scientific journal that he'd actually had an affair with the famous Sarah Bernhardt over the next 3 weeks.
Now, what happened to Loire after this?
He decided to marry a beautiful young French girl, the daughter of a professor. Her name was Marguerite. And he brought her out to Australia and he said, you know, you'll love it out here. But his island paradise was her prison. He would go into the laboratory all day and be in his own world and be enjoying himself. All she had was a piano and two French-speaking staff, and she became bored out of her mind. And then she fell pregnant, and she said, we must go back to France for me to have the baby. And he said, of course. So they go back. She has the baby, and she says, I'm not returning to Australia. And so he ended up in Tunis running the Pasteur Institute there, and he and his wife had two more children, two sons and a daughter. But by 1902, he'd run off with the governess, Helen de Montes, and he went round the world for 7 or 8 years, leading the sort of lifestyle that he'd always wanted to lead. Never equaled his uncle's fame, but he had an adventurous life.
During World War II, Rod Island served as a military facility, along with all the other islands in Sydney Harbour. But for decades now, it's been a public recreation space. Adrian Loire's old house is now a dance hall, with the floor so shiny you can see your face in it.
Thanks, Dave. See you then.
Yeah.
Have a good day. See ya.
See ya. But what about that plague of a billion rabbits?
Come, Melbourne, let us look far into the future.
Will I adventure where we catch the rabbit?
Come, Melbourne. Past the years 1950, 1960.
Australia had to wait another 60 years before the magic bullet, a biological solution to the rabbit, was found. Spearheaded by Dame Jean McNamara between the wars, with Francis Ratcliffe, Bernard Fennessy and Frank Fenner, scientists trialled and eventually released myxomatosis in 1950. Myxo, as we called it, was devastating. It's estimated that 500 million rabbits died in the first year alone. The rabbit industry collapsed overnight. Brian Coman was a small boy living on the family farm in country Victoria at the time.
I vividly remember it. The rabbits, you could walk all day in my part of the world and not see a rabbit. Now, you know, before that time, they were everywhere. We could go. We got quite good pocket money from rabbiting, and rabbits were simply all over the place. But after Myxo, you could walk all day and not see a rabbit. And my father was convinced that they would become extinct.
Yes, I've heard about myxomatosis. How does it work? Do you know?
Well, I don't know much about it, but it's spread by mosquitoes. When one rabbit's infected, it passes the disease on to another. It spreads that way. I don't know what the disease does to them, but...
Brian Coman says even country folk who'd always hated the rabbit were a bit shocked by the cruel effectiveness of the disease.
I had a friend, Bunny Fennessy, who was, of course, fortuitously named. That was his nickname when he was a boy, but... Bunny was involved in the early experiments with Francis Ratcliffe in 1950. They decided to pack up and come home for Christmas. And then I think it was on between Christmas and New Year, it may have been Boxing Day, I don't quite remember, Fennessy got a telegram from Ratcliffe which says myxomatosis has broken out on Moratunka Station, stop, please investigate, stop. That was the telegram. So away he went in his four-wheel drive, his old Land Rover, and He tells me he remembers walking to the crest of this hill, and there was a fence line there and a gate, and he leaned over that gate and looked down, and in front of him was this mass of dead and dying rabbits, blind rabbits moping around, birds of prey flying in the air, flies everywhere, stench in the air. And he was simply overawed by, I mean, he'd never seen sick rabbits before, really. Any time you've seen rabbits, they look very healthy. And he told me he was overawed by this experience, and suddenly he became aware of a man walking up towards him. He was a fisherman with a fishing rod, and the bloke said to him, you're looking at those rabbits, are you? And Fennessy said, yes. And the man said, they ought to hang the bastard that done that.
But whatever the outcome, day after day, the war against rabbits will be carried on. New methods of extermination will be found, old methods improved, in our Operation Rabbit here in South Australia.
You've got a situation here where an animal is causing immense ecological damage, not to mention economic damage, and you simply cannot let that go on. You have to act. And we're dealing, after all, with an introduced species. It's not native to this country. It's only been here a very short time. And we simply can't allow it to gain a foothold again. The cost environmentally and economically would be enormous.
Run, little rabbit. Yes, rabbit. Hit the road, little rabbit.
I'm on my way.
Shotgun, little rabbit. A bang, 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 bang. Find a log, little rabbit. Got my dog, little rabbit. You're in the fog, little rabbit. Bang, 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 bang.
Been listening to Louis Pasteur and Australia's War on Rabbits, produced by Lorena Allam with sound engineer Phil McKellar. Special thanks to Bruce Shying and the Sydney Heritage Fleet, and to David Thompson from the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Incidentally, you can visit Rod Island anytime. It's completely free of rabbits. Just go to our website for details. And while you're there, check out some of the stories from our extensive back catalogue. You can even subscribe to the podcast. And this has been the Earshot Podcast. I'm David Rutledge. Thanks very much for your company. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.